Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is writer and raconteur, Bob Dr. Mac Lovitis. Hi, Bob.
Hi, John. Thanks so much for having me. Hey. I've listened to the show forever, and I'm very honored.
Cool. Well, thanks for being on the show. I think this is going to be fun.
Me too.
So we've known each other since I started writing for the Mac Observer about 10 years ago, and I bumped into you at dinners and so on, and, you know, we've been in meetings together, but, you know, I was thinking the other day, I really don't know much about your early background, and since this is background mode, I am going to ask you about your early years and growing up. I know you have some cool stories to tell, especially about music. But what were you doing? What were you thinking about in high school and college?
I wanted to be a recording engineer. I listened to a lot of rock music and thought I wanted to discover the next Beatles or Stones and produce them and, you know, just hang out in a recording studio making music. And if that didn't work, I thought maybe advertising. So that's kind of how I educated myself. I got a degree in marketing and advertising. And
what turned you on about that? Was there some inspiration, some parent or relative or something?
No. I just thought the whole idea of, I grew up in the 60s, and TV commercials were kind of a new thing at the time, a new medium. And I was fascinated by you know, trying to tell a story in 30 seconds, television commercials, radio commercials, newspaper ads. I thought, you know, this is, I like the idea of being a communicator, and I liked the essence of advertising because you have to deliver the message in a limited space. So you have to be, you know, concise. And I just, there was something romantic about it. It turned out it was horrible. I hated it.
Did you work for an ad agency?
I did. I spent about 6 or 7 years after I got out of college working at an ad agency and a market research firm and public relations. It was a kind of a full service marketing company. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of things. I produced commercials, was an account executive for a while, wrote copy, and just kind of, you know, got a flavor of advertising. And after about 6 years, the Mac came out in 1984, and I said to my wife, I said, you know, I hate advertising. I made a big mistake. I think if you just let me buy one of those Macintosh computers, I'll figure out a way to make more money with it than I'm making working 80 hours a week at an ad agency and hating my job.
Well, I wanted to ask you about,
figure something out.
I wanted to ask you about ad agencies, because so often I watch commercials on TV where I go, you know, if I were the president of that company, I would have never approved that ad. Who came up with this harebrained idea?
Well, somebody's always holding the bag. There's always somebody that signed off, because if you're in advertising, you learn very quickly, don't make any decisions for the client without getting their initials on it.
Did you discover that certain companies had a very fine-tuned and accurate and graceful understanding of their product and translate that into demands of the advertising agency, and that some other companies were clueless and said, well, what do you think we ought to do?
Yeah, we did a range of different kinds of advertising. We had some retail. We had an early pay television company. We had a car stereo company. We did, you know, some of it was magazine, some of it was newspaper, some of it was television, and some of it was radio. And it was always interesting to me how little most clients knew about their product or their market, their audience.
As I feared.
Yeah, I think today it's different. I think today there's a lot more information available, and there's a lot more science to it, and there's a lot more that it's just a lot more visible. People think about it a lot more. So I think, you know, you got a different vibe going on than in the earlier days when it was wild and woolly. I know sometimes we'd have clients come to us and go, this is what we make, and this is where it's sold. And we haven't a clue where to advertise or what to say. And in that case, And it was cool that I worked for a full service company, because we would go in and think about all the different things. They'd say, you know, basically we have this much money to spend on marketing this year. What do we do? And you have to kind of then take it and put it in the buckets.
Was that the part you hated, or was the part you hated when the company
I hated it all. The problem for me was I loved making TV commercials. I loved going out with the crew and the team and shooting them, and I liked editing them. I liked post-production. I liked copywriting. I liked writing for radio spots. I liked a lot of things about it, but what I didn't like was that all of it cost so much money that I was only in my 20s, but I'd have gotten ulcers. Because the clock's ticking. You know, it's like if you're making a TV commercial, when you're doing post-production, the clock is ticking. And it was at the time 300 an hour. So that's probably in today's dollars, a couple $1,000 an hour. And to have that ticking in the back of your head, and knowing full well that if you don't do a good job, it's your fault, not the client's fault.
Right.
And if it takes five more hours to fix what you blew, you're paying for it. I mean, not me personally, but the company was, and it was frowned upon to do stuff like that. You know, you were expected to do it well and do it well and cheap and fast. And I used to say, wait. Cheap, fast, good. You can only pick two.
We used to say that at Lockheed Martin in terms of satellites.
Yes.
The government would want cheaper, faster, better. And we go, no. You can only get two of those.
We can do two. clients kind of don't get that. But anyway, it was a real experience for me. But part of the problem was it was very political, and you know, you could say the wrong thing at the wrong time and lose your job.
So
agencies expanded and contracted all the time, so you know, they'd lose a client and they'd suddenly shed 30 employees. It was just the pressure wasn't working for me, especially the part about I love making videos and doing audio production and post. But I hated having to do it in a studio where the clocks were ticking.
You know, that video production probably came in handy in your career. Previous guests of mine have worked at radio stations, been technical back support for disc jockeys. That's a perfect job to get into if you're going to be a podcaster down the road.
Well, it's come around. You know, I've used a lot of these things, and I'm getting to do more audio and video production, but I'm getting to do it on my terms. You know, I get to do it on my timetable and without having anybody, you know, holding a knife to my throat and a clock. You know, I can take as long as it takes, and it doesn't cost any more because all of the gear is in this MacBook Pro right here. The whole studio.
I want to talk to you about that some more in a bit, but let's go back to 84. You talked to your wife, and you're thinking that you can do something with this Mac to make a different kind of living. Tell me how that went.
Well, it was fun. I started with what everybody was doing at the time. I got a copy of, I don't know if you remember, Ready, Set, Go. It was the poor man's PageMaker. So I couldn't afford PageMaker, but I got this Ready, Set, Go app that let me do pretty rudimentary page layout and typesetting. And I ran around my neighborhood, and I did takeout menus for just about anybody that would let me through the door. And in fact, I did some of them on spec. I'd take their menu and I'd go home and I'm not a designer, but you know, redoing a takeout menu for a Chinese restaurant was pretty easy.
Did you have to buy one of those expensive laser writers to do that?
No, I had a guy next door that had a shop that it was called the Service Bureau. I don't know if you remember that, but you used to be able to walk in there and give them stuff, and they would print it on their laser printer. You'd bring in your 400K floppy or your 800K floppy and drop it off and say, you know, there's 11 files on there. And they took, like, you know, sometimes 15, 20, 30 minutes each to print. So you'd say, here, print all these on the disk, and you'd come back and you'd pay like a couple bucks.
That was smart, because I think Laser Writer, when it first came out, was something like $7,000.
Yeah, I wasn't about to buy one, but I didn't mind paying a buck a page for typesetting, because at the time, the agency was paying probably $1,200 a page to get real typeset. Now, the resolution wasn't the same. You know, the stuff that the agencies were using was probably 1,200 or 2,500 dots per inch. And it was printed on, you know, super fine, like, photo.
Yeah, but a 300 DPI laser writer looked awfully good in those days.
Well, and for most things, if you were going to have it copied, like, on a Xerox machine, mm-hmm. 300 DPI was all you needed, yeah. you know? Most yeah. of the stuff was being reproduced on cheap copiers. So, you know, I designed for that. And I did, you know, I did okay. And I also had some background in marketing. So I also was, I got a copy of Excel and I thought, oh, this is great. I can run crosstabs myself. I don't have to pay someone. Because I worked for a market research company and we'd go out and we'd gather all the data. And then to get the crosstabs run, to say, for example, show me the breakout of this question by age or by zip code or something, mm-hmm. we'd have to send all of the data off to a computer place where they would calculate all this stuff and send us back reams of those big computer papers, you know, with the hole punch on the top, giant green and white pages with the results.
Did you see yourself as sort of running your own marketing agency, own advertising?
I thought I could do that. It wasn't a long-term plan. I really had no long-term plan. I was just trying to pay the rent. Mm-hmm. And so I would do that, or I would do menus, or I would, if somebody wanted me, you know, at the time, we didn't really have photography or video or audio. I could only typeset. But I would do that. I would do market research. I had a spreadsheet, so I could do some of the things that were costing, you know, thousands of dollars when I sold them professionally, let's say. And so, yeah, I saw it as, oh, this is great. It's an enabling technology that lets me do some of the things I used to have to farm out for big bucks.
Did the ad agency cure you of going to work for somebody else, getting up in the morning and driving to work for somebody else? Was that what was happening to you at that time? Like, I'm going to do my own thing.
Well, once I got the Macintosh and made some money freelancing, I thought, you know, I realize I don't do well with the B word, boss.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to get fired a lot, and I talk back, and I'm not ideal. And I knew that about myself, and I thought, you know what, this whole having a Macintosh and being a one-man show and just selling stuff that I can make is a good deal for me. This is great. And then what happened was I pitched this guy one day. I said, so one of my clients, this is funny, one of my clients at the agency was PC Magazine, and they had hired us to do a readership study. So we did a readership study. We told them what their readers wanted more of, what they wanted less of. They loved us. So next thing I know, the marketing guy that hired us is at another publishing company. So he calls me one day, and I pitch him. I go, I could do the same job we used to do for you for $8,500. I could do the same thing for $2,500, and I can do it this week instead of in 4 months. How about that? And he goes, well, that might be good, except my editor-in-chief just quit, and if I don't find an editor-in-chief, like, within the week, my magazine that I just bought will go out of business, and I will be really screwed. Do you know anybody who could edit a Macintosh magazine? I mean,
well,
is that serendipity?
Let me think.
Is that serendipity? The guy who was at PC Magazine went out and bought this magazine from a guy in Texas who had started it, a guy like an oil well driller who had a Lisa and liked it. He started this thing called Macazine. And by the time this guy bought it, it had 75,000 readers. It was a, you know, pretty much a real magazine.
That kind of rings a bell, and I kind of don't remember it.
Macazine. Well, we didn't last that long. We were acquired by Macworld about 3 years after I got there.
Okay.
So it was from 1980, maybe 6 to 88 or 9. I think 89 is when Macworld bought it, maybe 88. So, yeah, it was a weird thing. It was like I had no really but in the meantime, I had discovered the Los Angeles Macintosh Users Group. And I was, you know, real active in that. I was at every meeting. I volunteered to do stuff. I'd sit there and copy disks for them. I really wanted to know what made these things tick.
You know, that's a good tip for the listeners, too. Joining a mug, a Mac users group, you meet people. And when you meet people, things happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I joined the mug. I actually, through the mug, found my assistant at the magazine who was probably the most proficient person I ever met in my life at Microsoft Word. And this is back when Microsoft Word was buggy and really horrible, version 1.something. And she could tame it. So if she's if you're listening, Vicky Jo, you were awesome. She really ran. She ran the magazine because she could type 150 million words a minute. she was like the grammar police, and she knew typesetting. She knew typography. It was awesome. Having her was just, you know, one of those things. Without this whole confluence of events, Chuck buying a magazine and needing an editor of the week that I called him to pitch market research, and me knowing Vicky from the user group, and all of this fell into place. And from there, I've never not been a Mac guy.
Well, I'm a little confused because before the show we were talking about your life as a roadie.
Before. Well, that was before. See, while I was in college, when you're in college, you're getting your degree, you can't really go to work in your field. I mean, you can maybe be an intern or something horrible, but you can't really go out and make any money or have any fun.
So that's back when you were trying to decide between advertising and music, right?
Well, in high school. It started in high school. I went to high school with this kid named Jermaine Jackson, who was in this band called the Jackson Five with this guy named Michael, who's now deceased, but he was really famous, and he was really talented. And so his brother Jermaine played bass, and we were in a bunch of classes together, and he was a great guy, you know. He'd invite me over, we'd go to his house, play basketball. He had the most they had a studio at their house, so it's like we'd go in his studio and I'd be drooling. They had microphones I could only dream about owning. And you know, isolation booth on a floating floor. It's wow. Like, oh, how do you do that at your house? I guess you have to be very, very rich. Can I play in the studio? Can I hit the drums a little? And they were great. You know, they were really fun. And so Jermaine looked at me one day and he said, why don't you come out on tour with us? And I laughed. I'm like, yeah, and do what? I was a big kid. I said, you want me to be your official food taster? He said, no, we'll teach you something. We'll teach you, you know, lighting. Lighting. Our lighting guy wants to retire, so we'll groom you to do lighting or something. So they taught me lighting.
Was this something where you would have to leave college, or was this sort of like summer?
No. Part-time? See, the Jacksons, Jermaine and I were in school together, and you can't just blow off school. So they would tour. We would leave Los Angeles on a Friday afternoon. Sometimes we'd leave school early on Friday. Mm-hmm. We'd do a show Friday night somewhere, fly somewhere else and do a show Saturday, sometimes Saturday afternoon and evening. And then often a Sunday matinee and a Sunday late show, and then, you know, an 8 o'clock show, and then a charter back to LA so that we could, you know, we'd get back at midnight or 1 o'clock and the kids would go to school the next day sometimes. Wow. But it was weekends, and it wasn't every weekend. And then in the summer, we would go out for 3 and 4 weeks at a time. And they were big in Vegas, so we'd go do 2 weeks in Vegas at a time. Which is really terrible. When you're a roadie in Vegas, you don't have any work to do because the union guys won't let you touch anything. If you're a lighting guy, all you can do is point at stuff and say, do this, do that.
Yeah, but you're on the road with the Jacksons. Yeah.
No, I'm saying you go to Vegas as the lighting guy, and you really can't touch anything. You can't put anything up. You can't aim anything. You can't
focus
anything. Oh, yeah, and you really, because the shows are short in Vegas. They're like, I think the show is 55 minutes. So, you know, you work maybe 4 hours a day, and, you know, you're in Vegas and you have 18 hours a day to yourself, or 20 hours a day to yourself.
No Not chance bad. For trouble there.
Not bad. Yeah, what could possibly go wrong? Right. Jermaine used to say to me, oh, this was really fun. He'd say to me, hey, I want my car in Vegas, but I don't want to drive to Vegas. Will you drive my car to Vegas? And his car was always something awesome, like a Rolls or a Carrera, Turbo Carrera convertible. And no, Jermaine, I don't want to drive your car to Vegas. how much will you pay me to do it?
All right, so well, how did you end up with Sean Cassidy then?
the same people I worked with on this tour with the Jacksons went on to become professional roadies and tour managers and stuff. Mm-hmm. And after Sean Cassidy, the whole group of them, they were, you know, sound reinforcement guys and lighting guys and band guys. They all kind of went together, and they worked for, I think, the Beach Boys for a while and Seals and Crofts for a while. And then in 1978, Sean Cassidy was really, really popular. And this was the year I graduated college. So I graduate college, it's summer, and Sean Cassidy is like the heartthrob of the year. And they've booked him on a massive, like, big arena tour. 30-some shows across, like, 2 months. And they need a really great crew. And so my friends that were on this, that were already doing it, said, why don't you come with us? I said, what? I haven't done this in years. I don't know if I could still do this. And besides, I don't know if, you know, I don't know if I could learn how to run a different lighting board in enough time. No, you won't be doing lighting. You're going to be Sean's guitar roadie. And Sean doesn't play guitar. I said, okay, that'll work. Now, I play guitar. I could be a guitar roadie. I can tune a guitar. So, for 3 months, I walked out on stage and brought Sean his guitar every night.
Mm-hmm. And, but I heard a rumor that you had something to do with the audio control of his guitar.
Well, the real band. And now, he had the best band. His band included guys from Three Dog Night and James Taylor's band, and they were really, really good professional musicians. Mm-hmm. And so after the first or second show, a couple of them came over to me and said, you know, Sean plays guitar on a couple of songs and he's really terrible and it hurts us on stage when we hear him and stuff. Now, we can turn him off in the PA so the people don't hear him, but we can't turn him off on stage. We're going to have to rely on you to do that. So what you need to do is, after he hits a few chords and the people hear that his guitar's for real, when the song starts,
see it coming.
Find his amp and put it on standby after a few chords. And then after the song ends, flick it back so if he hits a chord or something, it doesn't just
go
silent.
Did Sean know you were doing that?
Maybe.
He probably didn't care too much, as long as he was getting applause.
It was really loud. If you've ever been on stage with an 11 or 10-piece band, I mean, we had a percussionist, we had a saxophone, two keyboard players, two guitarists, bass. It was a big ensemble, and if you've ever been on stage with, you know, that kind of operation, the sound pressure levels are high. So he might not have noticed. I mean, he might have just thought we turned him down a little in the mix on stage.
Quite a flashback. Hey,
yeah.
Are you ready for a break?
Sure. Is it time for Kelly?
It's time for Kelly. We got to take a short break, and then we'll come back, and we'll talk about more Mac stuff and publishing. How's that?
The dulcet tones of Kelly.
Folks, we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back. I'm talking to Bob Levitis. So let's talk about how you got into book publishing. I had never heard this story about how that first happened. So you're experienced with Word, I take it, and the Macintosh.
Mm-hmm.
And so how did you decide to write your first book? How did that happen?
I didn't. I had no idea I was going to write a book. I was so busy trying to run a Mac magazine and, you know, find new writers and assign stories and edit stories and look at new products and, you know, just stay on top. I had no intention of writing a book. I hadn't even thought about it. But I went to a Macworld, and a publisher and what do they call her? An acquisition editor for one of the big publishers came over and said, have you ever thought about writing a book?
She knew you through magazine?
Yes. And she said, we've talked about it and we think you've got the right style for, you know, a MacBook. Mm. Would you like to write a book for us? And I said, can I think about it? Well, first I said, how much does that pay? And then when I got a satisfactory answer, I said, well, can I think about it and let you know? So I thought about it, and it wasn't a lot of money. It wasn't enough money to quit my day job, not even close. But I could do it at night, and at the time, I still hadn't had children and, you know, was married, and my wife was working, and it was the kind of thing we agreed was worth, you know, working late for.
How does a deal like that go? Do you get 10% of the gross?
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah. It's 10% of the net, and it's 10% of the retail, the wholesale. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if Amazon buys books for 65% off, I'm getting my percent out of the 35%. You know, it's not like, you know, I sell a $26 book and I get $2.60. That would be lovely, but it doesn't happen. The royalties are much. I mean, technically, you're getting 10%. And if your book sells, you can get 12 or even 13 or 14, maybe. But when you break it all down, all of the stuff that goes through Amazon is at a deep discount, which cuts you way down. Now you're selling electronic books, and they're a whole different formula. I don't know if I make more or less when we sell an electronic book. I mean, I really don't.
But did you feel naturally as an editor that this was a feather in your cap to have a book? And so, well,
yeah, it was good for the brand. And mm-hmm. I figured down the road, it couldn't hurt to be able to say, former editor of magazine and author of best-selling book, blah, blah,
right,
blah.
Right,
you know,
right.
It's a good credential, especially when you're a freelancer, because it's always, what have you done lately? You know, I know you got an Academy Award a couple years ago, but what have you done lately? So
what was
it
the first
worked
book?
For me. And the first book was, well, okay, so I pitched a book called How to Become a Mac Power User. And I thought that was a terrific book for me to write because that's what I was all about, was productivity and, you know, shortcuts and kind of not hacking, but res editing, resource editing, and fixing things and making them work the way I wanted them to. And I thought a book about that would be great because there weren't any at the time. There weren't any really MacBooks. So I sold this book, How to Become a Mac Power User. And right before it came out,
was this pre Mac OS 10 or after?
Oh, yeah. This is Mac OS 6 or 5.
Oh.
It wasn't even called Mac OS then. It was called System.
System 5. Something, yeah.
So whatever it was, maybe it was 6. So the book comes out. They say, oh, by the way, we didn't like your title, so we've changed it. It's now called Dr. Mac. So, okay, I guess. You know, I wasn't really thrilled with it at first, but it worked out, you know.
It sure did.
And it was, they said, all right, we're going to call it Dr. Mac. And I said, could we then call it Dr. Mac : How to Become a Mac Power User? And they said, well, no, the words power user have negative connotations. I said, to who? Everyone I know wants to be a power user. And they said, no, we can't have that in the title. I said, okay, well, let's make that. Let's
sounds too much like the evil master of the universe.
Well, yeah, let's figure out a way to say it without saying power user then. So the official title became Dr. Mac, Tips, Techniques, and Advice on Mastering Your Mac, which isn't horrible, but it isn't the same. So it was a big hit, and they let me do a second edition, and that was a pretty good hit. And then I got, I guess, an offer from the Wiley people to start writing Mac OS 10, you know, Mac OS. Well, at the time, it was System 7 for Dummies, System 8 for Dummies.
But these books don't. These books don't, like you said, don't substitute for the day job. So, how long did it take?
If you do a few a year, you can live off it. But mm-hmm. you know, you can't write one book like these and, you know, make a decent living at it, unless you're very lucky and it sells amazingly well. And also, they have a really short shelf life. Remember, all these Apple books have a one-year lifespan.
Right.
And then while I'm honored that they, you know, keep coming back to me to update my books, iPhone for Dummies, I just finished the 10th edition, and iPad is in its 9th. Mac OS is in its who knows, because it's had so many names. System 6, System 7, System 7.5, 7.6, 8, 9.
Mac OS 8, two yep. words.
Yep.
Mac OS 9,
with Mac a capital OS 10. M. With a capital M.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mac OS X, which is pronounced 10, or
right,
was.
Right.
So I wrote all those. And also, I wrote the... Oh, yeah, you asked about jobs. I did have a day job a couple times. One was power computing. I was the director of evangelism.
Oh, you were the Guy Kawasaki of power.
I wanted so badly to be Guy Kawasaki. And he knows it. I talked to him about it. I said, yeah. Guy, you know, when I grow up, I want to be you.
How did that go? Because power computing didn't last very long.
Oh, but being the evangelist was really fun. Mm-hmm. Because my job was to go to the user groups and talk. And, you know, that was like, oh, really? And you'll pay me to do this? Okay, I could do that. It was great. I'd go there with a bunch of hardware, and I'd give a presentation, talk about why ours were better than Apple's and why they cost less. And
did you have any misgivings about what you were doing, or were you all in? Like, this was the new wave.
For that, because we were supposed to, we're going to be Dell. We're going to build inexpensively what Dell builds. Right, a motherboard with an enclosure and a fan and a power supply and some storage and some memory. And so, you know, when you think about it, we wanted to build using the same chassis they were using to build PCs and the same assembly lines. And we wanted to be able to just put together, you know, ugly Frankenmonster Macs. But Dell was just getting started. So... We wanted to be able to build to order, and that was the big thing about us. Anyway, we were really hell bent on helping Apple by taking the low end, by, you know, no design, no style. We were using generic EC cases and power supplies, you know, sourced from the same place Dell was sourcing, and the whole idea was build to order was a big thing that Apple couldn't do at the time, and was in. It looked like. They had, you know, no intention of going there.
But you were bidding on some contracts that took some big business away from Apple, right? Because of the lower cost.
Well, I heard anyway. And then it got out of control, and pretty soon it was like, oh well, gee, if power computing keeps it going on the path they're going on, they'll buy Apple, and or Apple will fold and they'll buy the operating system out of the bankruptcy. I'm serious. This is the kind of stuff that we're looking for.
I know. Steve Jobs came back to Apple. He put an end to all of that.
Instantly. And I was so upset at the time because I was on the other side thinking, no, we're Apple's savior. But the truth is, we weren't. We were their worst nightmare because we were building high-quality products at low prices. And really, when it comes down to it, people will take a high-powered computer that works great at a lower price and is uglier every time.
Yep.
You know? I'll take a little uglier if it's going to save me money. And so that was what we found, and it turned out that would have put Apple away. They just couldn't do it. They couldn't build to order, and they couldn't build to order at the kind of prices we built to order. Unless they did what we did and just bought cheap components, you know, and hacked them all together.
So when did the book publishing business become your day job?
Well, after Mac Observer and Macworld, let's see. Okay, Macworld bought the magazine in like 89 or 90, and I worked for them for Macworld for a while. I wrote Beating the System. I wrote a bunch of columns for Macworld. No, wait. I went to Mac User first, and then they got bought by Macworld, and I worked for Mac after that. So I always was working for one of the magazines. I wrote for Mac Week for a while, and after Magazine folded into Macworld, I did a combination of freelance writing. I had a company that did seminars, and I did personal training and corporate training. I had a little company that did those a few times a year. And magazines used to pay real money. You know, if you had a column in a magazine.
Yeah, I used to.
That was real money. Yeah. And you know, it was a lot more work than it is today. It's like, you know, you had to submit the draft and an outline, and you had to have meetings with people and write it a couple of times. And today, nobody wants to pay anything, but they still want to rewrite three times. Not Mac Observer, though. I have to say, Mac Observer and the Houston Chronicle, I've been with both of them for like 20 years. And the truth is, maybe not Mac Observer 20 years. I don't think Mac Observer is even 20 yet. But I've been there a long time. And almost. I love that neither one of them ever has tried to muzzle me or tell me what to say or what to write about or anything. You know, it's like they're just, they realize that, you know, my stuff is in my byline, so it's an opinion piece. And that's my opinion.
If you get the right kind of writer and you just unleash him, things tend to go well.
Well, I love my editors at Mac Observer and at the Houston Chronicle because they basically just say, go find interesting stuff and, you know, write about it.
Yeah.
Which is exactly how you work with me. If you give me too much direction, boy, it's a problem.
I did
another startup after Power Computing was gone called NotHarvard.com. That one didn't end so well.
We won't go into that.
I got fired.
Beginning to sound a little bit like Jean-Louis Gasset. I was talking to him the other day, and he got fired
a lot. Yeah, well, you know, the problem is I'm pretty blunt. I sometimes can be my own worst enemy.
Well, be your own boss.
I don't have a good filter. I don't have a good filter for that kind of stuff with bosses.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's okay. If you're going to be your own boss and you have your own vision, go for it.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is I've always since then figured, okay, I can find enough freelance things that pay money to to equal a career like an ad agency or something, or you know, having a day job of some sort. I can cobble that together between a couple of books a year and some magazines and some online stuff and stuff that I sell myself and stuff that I make and personal appearances and training and consulting, and it all equals out to pretty much in existence. And I'm a lot happier. If I had to go somewhere for 8 hours a day and wear a certain kind of clothes and attend meetings, meetings make me nuts. I can't do meetings.
It's not for everyone. I remember at Lockheed Martin when there was this manager who liked to have these two-hour meetings, and it was mind-numbing. It was awful. Hey, guess what? We're really moving along in time here. We don't have a whole lot of time left.
Well, what else do we want to cover?
I want to ask you, because you're so deep into books for Macintosh users and professionals. I want to hear your thoughts about what I call the Macintosh situation. It's been so long since Apple's updated its Mac Mini and its Mac Pro and its MacBooks, and we have no idea what's going on, and Apple's kind of leaving us hanging, and hundreds of days of going by, and we don't see any updates.
In their defense... They've never shared their plans with us.
I know, but they've never gone so long either.
Well, that's true, but if they've got something up their sleeve, and at this point you got to think they've got something up their sleeve, and perhaps the whole line is getting overhauled.
You think the whole line is going to ARM, maybe? Maybe they're taking the entire Macintosh line over to ARM processors?
It could happen, but that wouldn't be something they would just spring on us. But there may be a whole new design coming. There may be a whole new architecture. I know there's a whole new file system. So, sure. They may be giving APFS. The Mac a complete start-to-finish overhaul. And all of the models, all of the laptop models, all of the desktop models, and even that other garbage can thing that nobody...
Hey, I'm talking to you on a garbage can. Hey, watch out now. I'm talking to you on one.
That's a 2013 garbage can.
Don't say that.
I know.
It's an awesome black monolith cylinder.
hey, I have a 2015 MacBook Pro, and the truth is, I don't know what else else I need, really. I mean, you know, yeah, you can make it a little thinner. You can make the battery last a little.
You think it's going to survive? You think they're going to just kill it?
No, there'll be something like this. I mean, there'll be something that serves this function. And the truth is, I could get by with almost anything now because the docks are good. As soon as I get the right dock,
yeah,
I don't. You know, I'm okay even with a MacBook with one port. I'll live. Hmm. If it had enough processing. But, you know, they'll always have a workhorse laptop model like the MacBook Pro. I don't think they're going to change the names. Maybe they will.
Sounds cool. I hope so.
But I you have to think something is going to happen with the Macs. It probably won't happen before Christmas because the time frame for that's running out. But there will be an iPad something pretty soon, right? We're moving into iPad announcement event territory. And at that time, they could do something with Macs.
An iPad and Pro with an A10 Fusion would be really cool. Well, A10X Fusion.
Interesting.
That would be fun.
Well, we'll see what happens.
Let me ask you one more question.
Yes,
do you
sir?
Think Apple will come out with a 4K Apple TV for Christmas with HDR?
I hope. God, one can only hope because I haven't bought
Roku's
my...
Roku's got one.
Well, I haven't bought my 4K TV yet because none of the things that I have work with 4K yet. And I couldn't replace the one I use the most, which is Apple TV, with one that works with that has 4K.
Yeah, yeah.
So I haven't bought the TV yet even, but I'm looking forward to it.
I've got my eye on an LG because it's OLED and it's got HDR.
Wow. Did you look at the that OLED screen, the slightly curved one?
I'm going to go with the flat LG OLED that has HDR and Dolby Vision. It's flat screen. I've looked at OLED and it's awesome.
You're looking at least 60 inch, right?
50. It's a 55 inch and it's like $2,500.
Okay, that's not terrible. By the time Apple gets off its butt and does a new Apple TV, I'm thinking I'll be able to find the 4K TV I want for a couple of grand.
Yeah. Yeah, and then we can start slowly rebuilding the system. Get a 4K Denon receiver.
Yeah, and then the big jukebox. You got to get a. What do you got to get? I've actually got a couple of Drobos I could probably repurpose. I'll repurpose those and make them just movie servers because those 4K movies are going to be chew up space at an alarming rate.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Better have a good.
And then I need a louder amp and louder speakers. And I mean, if you're going to have a better picture, you got to upgrade the audio too.
My plan is to kind of do it piecemeal. You know, get a basic system going and then add to it. Yeah.
Well, we're thinking of moving pretty soon, so I'm thinking that might be the good opportunity to like replace the system.
Right. Entirely. Just rebuild from scratch.
Well, yeah, because I'll have a different room, and I'll just, you know, when I know what the room's characteristics are, figure out what to do with the room and buy the equipment that's best for the room rather than take all my crap from here, which probably isn't the best stuff. I mean, it's great for here, but that's because I hung the back channel speakers from a 16-foot ceiling in the den, and, you know, it's pretty spiff.
It's going to be a fun adventure in 2017 with Apple and new Macs and maybe. New 4K TV
maybe.
And new maybe. Apple TV. And
maybe. Have you tried the AirPods yet? Is that what they're called? AirPods?
Right. AirPods. I haven't gotten a hold of a pair yet. I'm not
me
on
either.
My life is the D-list, so Apple didn't send me a pair for evaluation.
Well, they didn't send me a pair yet either. I'm on some list, I think, to get them. I don't think very many people have gotten them yet. But I'm interested to see that because I do listen a lot on Bluetooth headsets, and it's true. I have a hard time recommending them to people who don't have a high tolerance for aggravation because they come, you know, unpaired, and the buttons aren't clear.
I know.
People press, you know, there's always something.
I can't wait to see if I'm going to lose them. Because I keep worrying that I'm going to misplace it. Yeah.
Well, that's possible. I just ordered a couple more tracker, you know, those little Bluetooth trackers. I don't know if I could dangle one from a headset, but I have them on my keys because that's a really good thing.
I think some third-party company will come out with this really slick lanyard that connects
somebody
the
already
two
did
hanging
There's
around
a cable.
Your neck.
I heard it on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Oh.
They already have a cable for them.
All right.
It's the cable for the wireless headsets.
Well, that way you can take them out of your ear and just kind of lay it around your neck, see, and they just hang there until you're
exactly.
ready to put it back in your ear.
It's woven out of 18-karat platinum. And hey, did you notice that the 14-karat gold watches just quietly disappeared?
Do you
off
know
the...
why? I haven't heard.
I have to guess that, A, they didn't sell the way they thought, and, B, the thought of going forward and doing that every year and having that much, what I think maybe they had to go melt down for scrap every year, year in and year out.
Yeah.
It's not their core competency.
Sure will be an heirloom,
though. It was interesting the way they went from the $10,000 models to the, $2,500?
Yeah.
Ceramic.
Yeah.
Ceramic.
But if you've got one of those original gold watches and you still keep it going and working and get the battery, you know, updated after a few years, that could really go up in collector's value.
It could, or it could be like...
Or you could melt it down for the gold. Like
yeah. It could be worth what the price of the gold is 2 years from now.
Hey, guess
what? My thing with those gold ones was it always really kind of freaked me out because when you buy a gold Rolex, you know, watches work the same for 100 years plus, 200 years, and they will still be working 200 years from now.
Not the Apple Watch.
But
eventually, it'll be in
Watch
a drawer, and you won't be able to fire it up, and it won't work with the operating system.
In a year, it's obsolete.
Yeah.
Your $10,000 watch is obsolete in a year. You know, if I were Apple, I would have made that watch so that the interior was swappable. So each year you could
talk about
a
that.
Module.
No, yeah, when the Apple watch was first
that?
Starting to ship,
I'd
we
have
thought,
bought one.
Replace the guts, you know? Just
yeah.
swap it out.
I'd have bought that $10,000 watch as an investment
yeah.
if I thought it was upgradable, if I could, you know, get it goosed every year. But I realize I'm going to probably buy a new watch every other year or every year. Did yeah. you order an Apple Watch too?
For my wife. See, I have a Series still, 0, and I'm keeping it for a while, and then my wife gets
too.
The Series 2, 38 millimeter. I have a 42, and then
okay.
I'll buy an Apple Watch 3.
Next one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll swap.
I have an Apple Watch 0, and I like it, but I haven't decided if I want an Apple Watch Series 2 yet.
It's fast, I've heard.
I asked for a loaner. I asked for a reviewer so I could try it.
Mm.
And, you know, the same thing happened with the first Apple Watch. I wasn't sure if I wanted a $400, you know, watch that wasn't waterproof. But it turned out I like it a lot, you know. I bought one as soon as Apple took mine away after the review, and I said, okay, that settles it. I need one of those. So if I try it, I'll know better. I did get an iPhone 7S, 7 Plus.
Yeah, I love my iPhone 7. I have a black one. It's beautiful.
Me too. I have a jet black one. It looks like a expensive piano.
You better put a case on it because I've heard it can do micro scratches.
Yeah. I do believe that's going to be in my story that'll go up tomorrow. Yeah.
Okay.
That I actually quoted Apple, so you know exactly what they said about micro scratches. But you know what? It is in a case. And you know what? I call that... Because I watch the Antiques Roadshow, I call that patina.
Mm.
Those aren't micro scratches. That's patina. And that's value.
I'd love to keep on going with you. I think we could go another hour, but guess what? We're out
another
of time.
Time.
We're out of
Let's
time.
Another time. I've still got the second half of my career.
Hey, it was fun. Thanks for being on the show and chatting with me. This was really cool.
Thanks for having me.
Tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish. I'm sure they do, but tell them anyway.
Yeah, well, come to Mac Observer and leave a comment on one of the things I write there, or visit my website, sign up for my newsletter at workingsmarterformacusers.com.
Okay.
That's the name of my upcoming ebook. We didn't even talk about books and publishing and ebooks, but
yeah,
we'll do that.
We'll do that in part two.
Then,
we'll have you on the show again.
After I ship.
Okay, cool.
Awesome.
Well,
Thank
I want
you.
The listeners to know that this is the anniversary of Background Mode, done 52 shows. If you have any feedback, you can reach me at marty@macobserver.com. If there's something you'd like me to do or have somebody on the show, let me know. But thanks for coming by and listening to Bob and me chat. It's been great having you. And we'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.